This is a class on non-judgment.
Good segue.
Let's start with a few minutes of silence. this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. I'm going to check something on the camera. So, thank you again. And this will be the final evening in this series. And tonight, if we want to live in a cruel world without being cruel, then it's important for us to be able to be in the presence and to cultivate in ourselves the ability to be in the presence of people we disagree with or dislike or might even be afraid of, and be in that place without condemning them to hell in our hearts or without judging them. And that's what I want to talk tonight about, is how to cultivate that ability to be in the presence of people that you might not like or disagree with or might behave in ways that you have a tendency to be judgy about, and to let go of that judgment that's on your side. And what I want to start with is, because it's succinct and it's a good introduction, what I'd like to start with is the TED Talk that I gave at Burning Man. This past Burning Man, I was asked to do a TED Talk, and I did it on this topic. So here's what I said. The world now is too dangerous and too beautiful for anything but love. When my daughter was born, and I held my first child in my hands, something happened. I felt a love that was so strong, I knew it would never end. No matter what she did, I couldn't stop loving her. And believe me, she did a lot. But her misdeeds and her childhood cruelties never defined. I could only look at her through the eyes of love, as this beautiful, sparkling human, deserving of and capable of love. And I wonder, why don't I look at myself that way? And why don't we look at other people that way? I know for me, it's the mistakes that stick. I'll be having a conversation with a group of people, and I will say 10 amazing funny things and one stupid thing. And when I'm leaving, I beat myself up. I can't believe I said that. And in a moment, I am no longer Brian Baker, amazing human. I am he who says stupid things. And we do that to other people like that. Someone cuts us off in traffic, and we don't think, oh, I wish they'd made a better driving choice. We think, what an idiot. And in an instant, we move them into a category that's less than human. And we do it to entire groups of people. People that might have a different view on a social issue or might support a different political candidate. And it's not that we disagree. It's that we disdain. And it's even worse when we are with our like-minded friends smugly congratulating ourselves that we're not like them. You could make the case that this is the fatal flaw in the human condition, is our propensity to look at other people not through the lens of the best they can be, but through the worst they have done. I believe that is the point in the story of Adam and Eve. This foundation myth that lies at this creation myth that lies at the foundation of three of the world's major religions was written 3,000 years ago to answer one question. What went wrong? And in this story, God creates the heavens and the earth. And God looks at all that God made and God says, this is awesome. And then God makes the first humans and says, enjoy. And everything will be fine. Just don't do one thing. Don't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't call what I have created and declared good evil. And of course, they eat the fruit. And the next thing they do is this. They judge their own pure, unclothed human form as evil. I'm so ugly. I'm so fat. They cover themselves and they hide in shame. And then the storyteller tells us that God is walking through the garden as God did every day, waiting, you know, to hold hands with Adam and Eve and go for a stroll and chat, and they don't come out. They hide in the bushes. And God says, where are you? And they say, we're naked. We can't come out, and God's heart breaks. God asks, who told you you were naked? Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. Cain killed Abel, and here we are, practically unable to talk to one another. But it doesn't have to be this way. That's why the story was written. The story was written to show us what's wrong, to show us what we're doing, to hold up this mirror, and to invite us into a different way of being human. And I want to suggest three spiritual practices that can help you be less judgy, three spiritual practices that can help you look at yourselves and others through the eyes of love. The first is simply to pay attention to your thoughts. To pay attention to that inner critic that will kick in and have us halfway beaten to the ground before we even notice it. Pay attention to those thoughts. Pay attention to your inner critic. Realize that those thoughts aren't you. That those thoughts aren't God. And that those thoughts aren't helpful or healthy. Did you know that the root word for the word devil means to divide? For me, that's a helpful diagnostic tool. Anything that is about division, any thinking, right, any wrong thinking that we carry around that leads to division, either division in our own hearts or division in the world, is of the devil. Let it go. The second spiritual practice is to assume that everyone on the face of the earth is doing the best they can. Because everybody is paralyzed by fear and by judgment and by anxiety and by addictions. And we have no idea what someone's backstory is, the way that they were raised or the abuse that they've had to deal with. It's helpful to just give everyone the benefit of the doubt and assume they're doing the best they can. I have a friend whose Granny Barb used to say, everyone's doing the best they can, and sometimes their best is pretty shitty. Sometimes my best is pretty shitty. The third practice is to cultivate a curiosity about other people, particularly about people that you might disagree with or not like. Who are they beyond that one-dimensional thing that you have a problem with? Who are they as beloved children of God? I had a great opportunity to practice this third spiritual practice at Burning Man. A year and a half ago, my 23-year-old dreadlock tattooed, I'm more of a Buddhist daughter, came into two tickets to Burning Man, and she decided to ask her 53-year-old West Point graduate, Army veteran, Episcopal priest father to go with her. And at Burning Man, I had the opportunity to encounter lots of people that, because of my upbringing and my training, I might judge. But Burning Man expected better of me. And I would like to share with you one story. Prior to going to Burning Man, I got a message from a woman in my congregation. And the message, a Facebook message, and it said, "I hear you're going to Burning Man. I go to Burning Man every year. I stay in a camp called Poly Paradise. Maybe we can connect." Now, my camp, the camp my daughter chose for us to stay in, was Camp Perky Parts. And Perky Parts was a mannequin-themed camp. And I was thinking that maybe Poly Paradise might be a polyester-themed camp, and where people wore polyester clothes like, you know, I wore in the 70s to go to prom. And so I was figuring, you know, we would try and link up somewhere. And it wasn't until Thursday of the week of Burning Man. It was the Thursday of my camp's Thong Thursday party when this parishioner and I finally connected. And when we met, the first thing out of her mouth was, "I am so sorry I've not been to church lately. But you know, I'm staying at a camp called Poly Paradise. And that's a camp for people in polyamorous relationships. And while my husband lives in Sacramento, my boyfriend lives in San Francisco, which is why I haven't been able to go to church, because on weekends I'm with my boyfriend in San Francisco." Now, the first thing that popped in my mind was, okay, what you're confessing is you haven't been to church lately. Your justification is it's because you're with your boyfriend and not your husband. The second thing that popped in my mind was, how cool that you're telling me. How cool that you trust me enough to tell me who you really are and trust that I'm not going to run from this conversation screaming. And I have to tell you, we are much closer now because she told me than we ever would have been if she had kept it secret. The world now is too dangerous and too beautiful for anything but love. May your eyes be so blessed you see God in everyone, your ears so you hear the cry of the poor. May your hands be so blessed that everything you touch is a sacrament, and your feet so you run to those who need you. And may your heart be so opened, so set on fire, that your love, changes everything. Amen. So that was the talk I got to give at Burning Man. That was a lot of fun. And it's a good introduction. I want to sort of unpack some of the points I made in that talk. But it's a good introduction to the arc of what I want to talk about. And I want to, first of all, are there any questions or comments or thoughts or anything you want to share after hearing that?
Are you going to tell her that you told all of us that story?
Well, She knew I told everyone at TED and.
Oh, okay. This is.
Yeah, that was part of the TED talk. So yeah, I got her permission actually to include this in my TED talk. Any other comments? comments. So let me unpack a little bit my understanding of the fact that everyone's paralyzed, or my belief that everyone is paralyzed. And in theological language, that for me is what the church is talking about when the church is talking about sin. It's the fact that there is something keeping us from dancing wholeheartedly and freely through our lives. And that for every human, right, unless you've reached enlightenment, every human is struggling with stuff. And you can it can be being afraid, it can be having this judgy brain that's always kicking in and tearing yourself down. But like everybody is like trying to make it through the day the best they can. And I'm amazed that we're as good as we are to one another, given all the stuff that we have to carry around. And the Thomas Keating, who's a Trappist monk, who was very involved in the reinvigorating the practice of meditation in the Christian church, in the Catholic church specifically. When he talks about the human condition, he talks about the ways that this paradigm where everyone has three primary energy centers. Everybody is operating out of three energy centers, three places of need, and for each human, one of them is dominant. And the three energy centers, the first one is for safety and security. So you need safety and security, and each culture defines that differently. Like in some cultures, it's how many cows you have, right? So your culture will define what you need to have around you for safety and security. And for us, it's money. I read once of a survey where people asked, how much money do you need to be safe and secure and be happy? And everyone, regardless of their pay, said, 30% more than what they were getting, right? So there's this craving for safety and security. The second is for power and control. And the third is for esteem. Like, I want you to like me. And that one of the things that Keating talks about is how for different people, different ones are dominant. Okay? So for me, affection and esteem is dominant. Like, I want you to like me. It's important to me that you like me. So I'm less likely to steal. That's not my thing. I don't need that as much. But I do, that's my energy centers. I want you to like me. And it's so easy for us to judge people that are operating out of different energy centers because they're broken in a way that's different than us. And we can look at that and say, that's so horrible. Whereas each of us, has our own unique way that we're broken. And for us to acknowledge that we're all broken and that we're all struggling and we're struggling in different ways, but we're all struggling. And it's it's a helpful thing to realize this notion that everyone's a sinner. The reason that's helpful isn't because it allows us to then judge other people, right? That's why people don't like sin language, but I think we jettison sin language at our own expense. Because if we say, no, we're not sinners, then we have a different way of reacting when someone betrays us, right? How dare you do that? Whereas if we have this realistic understanding that we're all broken, and it's an invitation to be non-judgmental because we're all broken. We're all trying the best we can. That helps us set realistic expectations in relationships. We are destined to disappoint one another. That's helpful to know. That's helpful to know if you're getting married, right? We're destined to disappoint one another. And we're so bad at that as a culture because we think people should be perfect. We think our heroes should be perfect. And the minute they're not perfect, then they must be horrible. Right? We put our heroes on pedestals, and then we find out that there was a flawed side to the person. Well, then that can't be the hero. And then we look for someone else. I remember that in the debate around Dr. Martin Luther King, who did great things. And there were facets of him that weren't great. But that doesn't mean he didn't do great things and he wasn't a great human. And that's, we do that, right? We have these unrealistic expectations and we live our lives constantly disappointed. Rather than embracing the lovely truth that we are destined to disappoint one another. And it's how we navigate, how we keep our hearts open and loving in the midst of disappointing one another. That's what makes humanity work. It's not being perfect. It's being in communion in the midst of our imperfection. So that's one thing, right? It helps us set realistic expectations in relationships. It also helps us set boundaries. We need to have boundaries. If we assume that everyone here is broken, then we need to have boundaries, right? Because of course the bike's going to get stolen, right? If you leave your bike out, because someone who has that area of brokenness and that need is going to walk by and need the bike. And of course corporations are going to take money. It's what they do. So don't get upset about it. Set rules. Right? Rather than being all judgy about it, I can't believe corporations have profit as their motive. You set rules saying this is how you can operate if profit is your motive, right? And the more boundaries we set, rather than being indignant that someone did something, right? It creates this healthy, realistic way of being. And then when a boundary is violated, you enforce the boundary without judgment. Isn't that interesting? You stole my bike. Here's the ramification. I love you. You're a beloved child of God, but you need to do this. And you need to do this. Right? You take this whole judgy thing out of it. You are there. It's rather than saying you are now a bad human because you stole my bike. It's you are human because you stole my bike. And that's what humans do. And when humans do that, this is how we deal with it. So it's a different way of just lowering our standards in such a way. I think lowering our standards to reality and learning how to live in love with one another in reality. Any comments or thoughts? Yes.
It to me doesn't sound like lowering. Going back to the first class where you said when you call somebody a monster, you're letting them off the hook easily. Instead, what you're saying is you're a human.
Right.
Holding you accountable to being a human, which is a much higher standard. So I don't think of it as lowering.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So I want to talk about some spiritual practices, some things that can help us live in that world, right? If we're going to live in the real world where people are destined to disappoint us and we want to learn how to be in holy communion with people who are destined to disappoint us. And the good news is that we're destined to disappoint them, right? The spiritual practices of how to, when we're with people like that, that disappoint us, how to not be judgy about it. So the first, and I'm stealing this one from Jesus, is pray for your enemies. Pray for your enemies, do good to those who persecute you. And that in terms of, don't like pray that they break their leg or pray that they change and see the world as you see the world. But pray that they're free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Pray that they live a long, thriving life. Pray that they come alive in their heart and soul. Pray that they're free from their paralysis. Pray for your enemies. Pray for your enemies. Pray for your enemies. Which forces you, right? It makes you remind yourself, call into your own mind the fact that they're human and not a monster. And that they're a beloved child of God, deserving of and capable of love. So pray for your enemies. So whoever it is, like every day, add that person to your daily prayer. So pray for your enemies. that they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. The other is to cultivate humility. And there are a couple of things I want to say about humility. One is to realize that, like, all of us see through a glass darkly. So to cultivate intellectual humility, we all see through a glass darkly. We all struggle with the truth, right? We don't know, right? We're not right. If we're lucky, we're half right about whatever it is we believe or we think, right? Half right would be good. I would settle for half right, right? And what I believe and know is true is different than what I believed and knew was true 20 years ago. And so to sort of not cling so tightly, I hold on loosely to what we believe. And I'm not saying don't have conviction about, like, don't stand firmly, but you can stand firmly but hold on loosely to your rightness, right? It's more important to be loving than to be right. And hold on loosely to your rightness. And one of the things, I believe that like everyone walking around is half right. We just have to think right. The question I ask of an opposing position is in what way is it true? Because there is a way it's true. And there's a way it's true for the other person who thinks this, but there's also there's a way that it's true that your own heart can resonate with. Like there's some way, some rock they're standing on in their conviction that you can go, you know, I see how you can think that way. Right? And to have humility rather than constantly throwing stones over who's right, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. Say, well, you know, I'm kind of right. And I can see you're kind of right. So to have that kind of humility in terms of your own rightness. I talked about cultivating curiosity. And the thing that concerns me about how we're living as a culture is the ways we're siloing. And we're not having opportunities to have real conversations with people on other sides of issues because of our separations. And one of the things, so it's one thing to talk about cultivating a curiosity. It's another thing to engineer encounters so that we can actually have those conversations and get out of our monolithic worlds of like-minded worlds. And have those engagements that can help us really understand the ways in which people that scare us are right. The ways in which, you know, the wisdom that they hold. So I'm reading a book. I can't remember the title. I'll look it up. Actually, I'll tell you what it is. It's on my Kindle. After the election, there was a list of it's like 15 books to read in the Trump era. And so I started reading two of them. And one of them, it's called The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, by Jonathan Haidt. The Righteous Mind is the title. And it's a fascinating book. The first part, I just finished the first part, and the first part just lays out all kinds of psychological and sociological studies to make the point. And the point is, we're not rational beings. The point is, we are emotional beings with great brains. And the great brains are great at justifying the world that our emotional being chooses to live in. And in terms of becoming less judgy, understanding how like people are coming to decisions is like this book is really helping me understand the world I live in and people who are making choices in this world that I can't fathom and I can't understand their reasoning. This book is really helping me understand how we as humans work and how if we want to have a real engagement that changes things, it's not by the intellectual argument. And what are the ways that we can structure engagement that help us move beyond our impasse over the intellectual argument? So that's another strategy for moving beyond this judginess is helping to understand, like become more informed about how we're making decisions and why we're making decisions. How does this human organism work? And another thing along those lines is you will notice in Sacramento opportunities to take classes on implicit bias. And unconscious bias. I'm finishing up a program on unconscious bias, and I was trying to figure out how to roll out a curriculum in my church and in other groups, and then I noticed other groups starting to offer programs in unconscious bias. I just got one today from the Unity Center offering a program in unconscious bias. And they're learning fascinating things about how we make decisions and how these decisions are based on biases. Like tons of little tiny biases that we don't even know we have. And that there is the Implicit Project, I think, out of Harvard, where you can go online and take all these tests that check your brain to see how they're wired. And it can be wired in terms of race, religion, appearance, all kinds of stuff. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating. And then the goal is to help. One, help us understand our biases, but also to help us learn anti-biasing techniques. Like if we know these biases are triggering in our brains, what are the steps we can take so that we have a little more control? Because part of what we're realizing is we don't have free will. Right? Our brains may think we want to do this, but we have this emotional being that's pulling us in this direction, and then we have these biases we don't understand. One of the things, there's this other thing called priming in this, and this is getting a little bit off of the tangent, but it's fascinating. Priming, where someone would be doing a survey, and before the survey, it was something about how's your day going or something like that. And before they asked the question, the guy would say, oh, could you hold this for me? And he would hand him a cup of coffee. And hot coffee to some people, cold coffee to others, and the hot coffee people were doing better. Like if they held a hot beverage before they answered the question, their question was more positive than the person with the cold beverage. Something else I remember from the class was prior to administering an SAT type test, if you were asked your race or your gender, and your race or your gender was stereotypically bad in that area, you did worse on the test if you were asked your race or your gender before you took it than if it wasn't asked at all. It was like 80-point difference on the SAT. Right? These little things that trigger in our brain. And like if people are being triggered by these little things that they don't even know about, how can we judge them for the fact that they're behaving this way? The real question is, how do we love them? How do we love people? How do we love ourselves when we're being triggered by all these things that are outside of our, not only our control, but our awareness? How do we love ourselves in the midst of that? So I think becoming more educated about how the brain works can help us. And then we'll get to the big thing now, which is forgiving. Forgiving is... like, that's it, right? Learning how to forgive, learning how to let go of the ways that people have harmed us. And I want to talk about forgiving in a particular... I want to talk about this with a particular understanding of what forgiveness is. In my mind, forgiveness is letting go of your moral superiority. It's letting go of the juice of anger, right, or disdain, or whatever it is, moral superiority that you hold in your heart over someone else. It doesn't have to do with them. It's different from reconciliation, right? It's different from restoring the relationship. It has to do with how you look at other people, someone that harms you. So Jesus, after his resurrection, blows on his disciples and gives them God's Spirit, like he breathes in them, and says, if you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained. In my mind, to retain, to hold someone in their sins looks like this. 3 years ago, you hurt me. And from that moment on, I never really saw you. I only saw you through the lens of how you hurt me. And I will never let you go. I will always hold you in that. You are that person. That's what it means to hold someone in their sins. To free them from their sins is to realize that they are a beloved child of God, deserving of and capable of love. And they did this thing. But that thing does not define who they are. They're a human that's done 1,000 things, and one of them was that. Right? It sees them in their broader scope of who they are as a human, rather than, you're this person that did this to me. The goal for me in forgiveness is that. It's letting go of that juice in my heart. It's letting go the right I think I have to condemn them to hell in my heart. Like, you hurt me. Go to hell. Now, Desmond Tutu, he has a great book on forgiveness. It's the one where he talks about that monster thing. He talks about 4 stages of forgiveness. Let me back up. Let me say that forgiveness is a lifelong practice. Like, learning how to be able to forgive is a lifelong practice, and it's something easier said than done, and it's harder or maybe impossible for really bad violations. And so it's a process. It's not like, oh, I should forgive. I forgive you. I had something happen probably 15 years ago, where someone did something to me, and it wounded me so deeply that I could not forgive. And for years, if I was in a restaurant having lunch and that person walked in the restaurant, it ruined my lunch. Right? Now, who's that hurting? And I could not forgive this person. Now, 15 years later, not only have I forgiven him, but I realize he was an angel in my life. I learned so much. I'm such a better person because of that encounter. But at the time, I couldn't forgive the person. I couldn't even pray that I could forgive the person. I had to start with praying that one day I'd be able to pray that one day I'd be able to forgive, right? You just keep backing up until you can finally do something along those lines. And what Desmond Tutu breaks forgiveness down into 4 steps. The first step is just telling the story. This is what happened. The second step is naming the hurt. And this isn't something necessarily you're doing with the person that hurt you, right? It's something you're doing in your head and with your friends. This is what happened. This is why it hurts so bad. The third is to forgive. Third is to let that go and say, I love you. I see you as a beloved child of God, deserving of and capable of love. I no longer define you by this misdeed. And then the fourth is to either restore or release the relationship. Because it's not your obligation to remain in relationship with the person that hurt you. If you can't trust that that person isn't going to hurt you again, you can release the relationship. Or you can restore the relationship. I don't know if that's the word he uses, but what he means by that, with the word, is it's going to be a new relationship. It's not going to be the old, you're not going back to the old relationship. Something has happened. And if you restore the relationship, if you release the relationship, you may never talk to the person again. You may never talk, like, the person may be so dangerous that you can't have a conversation. if you're going to renew the relationship, I think renew was the relationship, the word. If you're going to renew the relationship, then you're going to have to talk about the thing that happened. And your relationship is going to be different. It's not pretending it didn't happen and going back to the old way. It's entering into a new relationship where this thing is part of our history as two humans. One of the points in that, the two points that I want to, that are helpful for me in laying those four points out, is that it can take time. Forgiveness can take years for you to get to step three, where you're ready to let go of that in your heart. And forgiving isn't forgetting, and that forgiving isn't allowing, like, you can still have boundaries and consequences. You can still send someone to jail. Sending someone to jail doesn't mean you forgive them. To forgive them means they go to jail. You're just no longer, like, sending them to hell in your heart. So it has to do, when I talk about forgiveness, it has to do with what's happening in our own hearts when we're thinking about or in the room with someone who has wronged us, and whether or not we're able to look at them through the eyes of love. Say, I love you. You're a beloved child of God, capable of and deserving of love. That's the goal, and for me, that's one of the primary pillars of a lifelong spiritual practice, is being a person of forgiveness and learning how to forgive and not hold people in their sins. And you can see, like, if you have this picture of the world where everyone is broken, right? We're all clumsy because we're all, like, scared, right? And we're all clumsy, and we're going through this world like clumsy bumping into each other. If we're all just holding people in the way that they've harmed us, right, then everyone is bound. Like, everyone is just being constantly bound by the mistake. They're binding themselves because, ooh, I messed up, and they're binding everyone else. And you can see, like, I see, like, God looking at all of this and going, oi, I created you to dance, and you're all bound. If you hold someone in their sins, they're held. If you free them from their sins, they're freed. For me, it's a statement, it's a descriptive statement. It's not a prescriptive statement. Jesus is saying, this is the way the world is. He's not saying you have the choice. Right? If you're going to follow me, then you're in the business of freeing people from their sins. But by the way, if you don't, you hold people in their sins. You hold the world in its sin. So go, forgive, forgive, forgive. So I have another piece I want to talk about, but let's stop there for a minute, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. What has anything I said resonated at all with any of you? That's what I want to know. Yes?
I love the moral superiority piece.
Yeah.
It's just naming that which is in the room, and then when you do, it's so much easier to, like, go. There's something about it that just, like, catching that bug that's been buzzing in your ear,
right,
and you can set it out.
Well, it's part of the juice, right? When someone hurts us, for us to go, well, I'm so glad I'm not like that person. I would never do that. To be that, hold on to that moral superiority that we can have.
Yeah, it's just so easy to lose direction at that time, and again, getting cut out and I'm right. Because I'm somehow better.
Right.
But then not seeing it as this thing that actually causes that experience. It's my own moral superiority. And it's like, oh, I'm just doing this thing, doing my own brokenness.
Right.
Yeah. Super helpful.
Thank you. Yeah?
When you mentioned that to renew the relationship with somebody that has hurt you, why for? Why is that a good thing if that person, maybe you're trying to fix in your mind, or you're trying to forgive in your heart, but the other person hasn't changed.
Well,
the other person doesn't care at all.
Right. My point is, you don't have to renew the relationship. You can release the relationship. If it's that kind of relationship, then your other choice is to release the relationship. You know, 95% of the people that do something to us, it's not, either it's not that bad and we can restore the relationship, or, you know, that there's been a shift and you can restore the relationship. But there are those relationships that aren't going to change.
Well, you can trust in the person.
Right. Then in that relation, then the point is, because so many people think if you forgive, that means I have to stay in the relationship. And the point that Desmond Tutu is making is you don't have to stay in the relationship. You can choose to release it. And then the other point is if you do choose to stay in the relationship, it's a different relationship because you're not forgetting. It's not forgiving and forgetting. It's forgiving and having this new adventure.
Setting more boundaries with that person.
Right.
Because
exactly.
Obviously they don't change.
Right. Yeah.
This was back a bit, but when you were talking about people are destined to disappoint, I've studied that sort of teaching a lot over the years, and I've been focusing on it, and it was really interesting when you said that, because I've felt this, every time I hear that, there's some sort of, like, something's being taken away from me feeling, or, like, and I realized what that was, it's how much I expect that they are going to make me happy, or, you know, it's how much I'm, like, holding on to that sort of thing, and I just realized that when you were saying it, so that was, it was really interesting, because I get that sense if I'm teaching yoga or something too, and I say something like that, there's like this like paralyzed sort of feeling in the room of like, no, not that, or, you know, like some resistance. So that was interesting. Thank you.
Yeah,
it might be a little off topic, but it's so much easier for me to look at a person, not an entity, but a person, and, you know, forgive, but not accept. I mean, accepting is not hard. It's not easy. So, I mean, that's a little, but I can see the person and their circumstance of forgiving. Accepting is not.
And what? How do you define accepting? What does that mean?
That's a great question. Not, like, I can let go of the anger toward the person, but not the anger and disappointment of the situation, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe let go of some of the blame, but not the situation.
Okay. So I want to touch on a slightly different topic. I want to shift from letting go of judgment in terms of our interpersonal relationships, right? The way we judge other people. And I want to shift to use those same kinds of ideas in talking about the circumstances of our lives. I think the primary teaching of Jesus is change the way you see the world. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The word metanoia that gets translated repent literally means to change. Metanoia is the gnosis, your understanding. It has to do with either, it means one of two things, either change the way you understand things or put on the larger mind. Change the way you see the world. Change the way you're thinking. You're trapped in wrong thinking. Right? Change the way you're thinking. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. And for me, it's an invitation for us to see the kingdom of heaven in our lives, right? Right now, everything you need to be fully alive is here right now. You're just not living it, right? You have the relationships you need, right? So wake up, change the way you see the world. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. And the problem is that we judge everything as not kingdom of heaven, right? We judge our jobs as not kingdom of heaven, you know, and we're trapped in if only. Like, if only I had this and if only I had that, then it would be kingdom. Then I'll talk to Jesus about kingdom of heaven, you know, but now, certainly not. So because of the way we judge, like, we live in scarcity, From the minute we wake up and say to ourselves, I didn't get enough sleep, to every other moment in the day, we're living in scarcity. And we're trapped by what we're not getting, what we don't have, rather than seeing the beauty and glory of this present moment. And so part of judging, like not judging, is not judging the present moment as sucking. Which wouldn't that be great if we could just love the present moment and realize that this present moment is the kingdom of heaven brought to us. And my favorite parable is, let me back up. There's a folk tale from China and there's a folk tale from India. And they're both telling the same kind of things. And I'm fascinated that they're both from these two different cultures. One is there's a guy, like a farmer, who, and I haven't looked at these stories in a while, but there's a farmer who a horse comes onto his property, a wild horse comes onto his property, and all the villagers go, that's great. And he goes, I don't know if it's great or not. Right? Do you know this story?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that story. There's another story, I think this the second one is from India, where a noble gets, I think it was a king, has an accident and his toe's chopped off and his advisor says that's good, and he has this advisor that always says that's good to everything that happens, and the king gets incensed and he fires the advisor. And the king then gets captured and he's about to be human sacrificed and they realize that he's not a perfect human form, so they free him from his human sacrifice and then he rehires his guy. You know, it's the guy who always says that, you know, his response to everything is that's good, that's good, that's good, right? Because God can work everything for good. But we have this way of judging, and we're the opposite, right? Everything's not good. That's not good, that's not good, that's not good. And from the teachings of Jesus, my favorite, one of my favorite parables is the parable of the mustard seed, where Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that you plant in the ground and it grows to be this great bush. Now, the thing about parables, the parables of Jesus are like Zen koans. They're designed to not make sense. And this parable doesn't make sense. But we don't know it doesn't make sense because we don't live there. And a lot of people think it's a smaller to greater story. Like, pay attention to the little things. The kingdom of heaven is found in this tiny little seed that grows into this big bush. Well, if that's what Jesus was trying to say, the mustard bush was the wrong thing. He should have said cedar of Lebanon, because that's the metaphor for the big thing. The big thing is the cedar of Lebanon. The mustard plant was a weed. It was the Jewish law forbade mustard plant to be planted with other crops because it would just take over. It was this intractable weed where the roots would go wherever they wanted and you couldn't get rid of it. And it's something that we label, that they labeled as being an annoyance, right? Something we see as an annoyance that roots will go everywhere and you can't get rid of it. That's what the kingdom of heaven is like. The kingdom of heaven is like this tiny little mustard seed. For me, the analogous parable is the kingdom of heaven is like a dandelion seed that blows wherever the wind blows it, and it lands in the middle of your beautiful, precious green grass and grows to this beautiful, you know, becomes these beautiful flowers, right? We see it as weed, and we don't realize there's this beautiful thing happening in front of us. Change the way you see the world. Stop judging every moment of your life as not kingdom of heaven. Change the way you see the world. Realize the possibility and the potential of kingdom of heaven is right here in this moment. So open your eyes, open your hearts, let go of judgment, breathe, and live in this world that's the kingdom of heaven now. That's the other facet, I think, of letting go of judgment, the way we judge our daily lives. And that's what I have to say. So thank you very much. Yes?
When you talk about this judgment piece, what comes to mind is what I've learned here about, you know, in Buddhism, I'm not Buddhist, but the teaching I've read is the, you know, judging in the form of liking and not liking, right? So it's holding on to stuff, I call it good. The aversion of stuff I call bad. And so I hear the similarity there, the equanimity of like not attaching or pushing away,
right,
is what I hear you saying.
Right.
So it's nice to hear that similarity leading through.
Yeah, and it's you know, to think about that in terms of our human relationships as well as, you know, events in our lives and just being able to be without that layer of labeling it.
Our perception of something as opposed to saying, this is my experience of it and there's something else out there.
Right. Any other thoughts? Yes?
It seems like there's another extreme that's easy to go to, from like completely judging and then totally not judging anything. Like, oh well, you know, everything's fine, or kind of like nothing matters extreme, something like that. Or not judging someone else then leads to harshly judging myself or something like that. Like, oh, I must be wrong and they're right. Or, you know, it seems like there's some extreme that I, in my experience, that I go to.
Right.
I mean, not that, it's probably not as bad as the harshly judging, but but it's not the middle ground where there's maybe a healthy place.
So can you help me understand what you're, the thing that you're saying you go to? What do you mean by that?
So something happens and maybe someone did do something that's inappropriate, but instead of, like, out of fear of judging them, I'll say, oh, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not inappropriate. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way and they're actually looking at it the right way. Or, you know, something along those lines.
Right.
It's like the other extreme.
So I was talking, I was on this topic with a class with Lama Marut a couple of years ago. And he touches on this in his book, like the motorcycle book. I can't remember the title.
Renegades.
Yeah,
Rides,
I think
life,
that one.
I think.
But he touches on the different, like, we have to make judgments. So the difference between needing to make judgments, needing to make, like, this is inappropriate, this is not okay, I can't abide this, and being judgmental, which is you're a bad person because you did this thing I can't abide. And I think there's a distinction there between, you know, we have to have, we need to make choices in order to set those boundaries. It's just what's the emotional component that gets engaged when someone violates that boundary. I think that might help with that distinction.
Yeah.
But it's tricky.
Mentioned that from my experience that there is this floodgate that's going to open if I, like, there's this fear that the floodgate is going to open if I'll dare to judge the situation, because then I'm going to judge the person and maybe I'm wrong and then I'm going to beat myself up for the next few months and it's all going to be a mess, so it's easier to just say, oh, forget it. And it's this, that line between judgment and judging. Yeah, that's
brand new
to me.
And frankly, we're entering a new era. This is a whole other can of worms. in the academy. So philosophically, the postmodern philosophy has been moving away from strong distinctions between ultimate truth, distinctions between right and wrong. So there's multiple truths, right? Has been this sort of trajectory where the liberal academy has been moving into postmodernism, where truth is relative. Now, it's a luxury, right? You have to live in a certain kind of world. You have to have a certain kind of privilege to have the luxury to think that way. If evil starts coming, and you have to say this is wrong, right? I think what's happening is people are realizing that there are boundaries that we might need to be set that we haven't been thinking that need to be set, and that we need to rethink our philosophical underpinnings, right? There's got to be something between absolutism and relativism. And what is that? And there's this sort of liberal bias toward, it's the same thing that I started pushing against when people would say, you know, we need to give up sin language, like we're all gods. You know, there's loveliness about that. But when we say, you know, we're going to jettison sin language, you have to live in a pretty privileged place where you can hold on to that as being true. And I think there's a more realistic and healthy and helpful way of looking at everyone as being broken. But I think the same thing true of moving from everything, anything goes, to this is really wrong. And not only do I think it's wrong, but I'm going to stand shoulder, arm in arm and shoulder against shoulder with other people saying this can't be, right? So I think we're coming to this shift. And there was an article I was reading today that was just about that very topic.
Yeah, because with Trump, we were talking about the election last few weeks. What I've seen too is like this reluctance to say that some things that he said during his campaign were not right. Like, well, maybe he just said that for this reason. And you know, that is true. But then in a certain level, too, some of the things that he said were not right.
Right.
And there's, maybe it's the spiritual bubble that I live in or something, but I see that in myself, too. And it's kind of it's a hard line to walk when you're practicing a spiritual life and trying to be compassionate and kind, to also find a way to express things are not right without stirring up a lot of hatred and, you know, like condemning someone and just the other way sort of thing.
I think that's the struggle of our time, and that's the struggle for these kinds of communities. Right? There are other communities for whom the dilemma you're wrestling with isn't very real, but for this community, right, this non-judgmental, let's love everyone community, there's a time when we need to change that message. And then how do we do that, right? And that's part of why I want to talk about this, is how do we stand up against cruelty without becoming cruel? How do we do that?
Setting those boundaries and saying this is wrong without the moral superiority.
Right.
That's That's a fine edge. Because the truth, as you said, you know, truth has many branches now, depending on your position, your upbringing, if that's how you were raised and your parents taught you that way and that's what, you know, you were taught in truth, that's your belief system.
And part of it is coming up with what are your values, like how do you articulate what your values are? Like what is it that you stand up for? And for us in my tradition, you know, respecting the dignity of every human being.
If it comes a point in your life when you're an adult and you think that you need to live for your own truth, you need to be responsible for your own actions and thoughts and feelings. I understand what you said, maybe you were raised a certain way, or maybe you were born in a certain place, or this or that. But it needs to come a point that you have to be responsible for your own.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And why? In the consequences of your actions. If what you believe in is true and it's going to be good and benefit for somebody else, then you go for it. If it's not, then it's not even good for yourself.
Yeah.
But I also think holding someone accountable is a form of love, like the parental analogy from the beginning. Like, just calling people out on their bullshit is a kind thing to do a lot of times.
When we were talking about, and I don't know if I said this, a couple of weeks ago we were talking, the clergy staff at the cathedral, about responses to bullying and how the shift in schools went from people bully because they have low self-esteem and we have to help their self-esteem to the response being, it is not okay. And that was a more effective response by just being calling them out on their bullshit, saying, this is not okay. You can't do this. And then, so what are the guidelines we use? Like, what are the values we use to say what's not okay and what's okay? And how do we articulate that so that people can understand this is where I'm coming from? We have to respect the dignity of every human being. I have my list, and we're working on that as a church. And then what are the practices that help us grow stronger so that we can hold on to those values even when it costs us? Right?
Mm-hmm. We want people to like us, you know, and sometimes it costs us face.
Right. It can cost us. If we're going to stand up for what our values are, it's going to cost us. And how do we, because it's one thing to have espouse liberal views, right, when it doesn't cost us anything.
Right.
But what is it going to matter? I mean, how do we do this when it's, and that's what you're talking about. Like, how do you have these hard conversations when it's going to cost you?
As you're talking, the whole time I'm thinking, I just don't have the energy for this. And it's mostly, I want to fight for what's right and for what I believe in. But it seems like every time I have a hard time sort of balancing that with being inclusive. And that's where I'm really paralyzed at this moment is, I come from the Midwest. I come from a very small town. Those people that I didn't really vote the same as I know. So I don't have any deep-seated hatred for these people, but to cross that bridge and to kind of see their side, and it just takes energy.
Right.
And when I get in the midst of it, I got too much stuff going on, but I want to fight for what I guess I have a hard time kind of battling for what I feel passionate about and still caring.
Right.
I don't really see their side, or I have a hard time kind of.
Right. That's, yes?
Before you mentioned that we need to make our choices, right? Even if sometimes those choices are really scary, or I'm feeling sometimes like I'm getting alone. I'm losing friends, I don't have my family here, and this and that. It's like I'm just trying to be a better person every day, and it feels like it's giving me the wrong consequences. My friends, we're not friends anymore, or sometimes I try to say something and they don't like it because it's the truth, and the truth hurts sometimes. And it's like, okay, I can understand that it hurts you, but it's the truth. No, it's not even something offensive, just in general. And I'm feeling like I'm getting less and less friends now.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts. It feels like they're excluding you, or you're being excluded from the world. I think I don't have this group, or
right.
That we can understand each other. I'm feeling a lot that I'm being more alone than before.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts.
Thank you. Yeah.
Very good. So it's kind of basically phrasing things. It's a change of thought from expressing something in a negative into a positive,
mm-hmm.
or even a neutral. Instead of saying no smoking within 20 feet of the door, we can say smoke-free zone within 20 feet of the door. I mean, things like that. It's in the simplest of terms.
Right.
And even when, speaking on politics, it can be the same. Instead of saying you can't do that because it's why shouldn't it be like this? Why can't we have,
Right.
The ideals like you said, fear and judgment are anger and resentment, and these are all negative attributes. We need to go to the positive attributes, or neutrality if possible.
Thank you. Yeah. Brandon?
I've been, ridiculously vocal at
Facebook like the last 3 weeks or months, which I've never been in my life, and I'm like embarrassed about it, and like the whole like, am I going to think about me this big thing? And I've had the greatest back and forth with like, I have either very few friends that are actually Trump supporters, or of my like 800, 900 friends, which I only know probably 100 of them, or they're very quiet, but I have a couple, and so that I do know personally, and so sometimes I'll post something and then they'll comment some snide remark, or they'll post something and then I can't help myself. So what I've been able to do a couple times, like when this person like posts something, I'll like write my thing, and then I'm like, okay, I just pause. And then what's helped, and I've noticed the pattern that helps, is like pausing, stopping, and realizing that first and foremost, I love this person. Like I do. Like this is a person, I haven't seen them in 10 years, but I know they're a good human being. And like, and I go back into that heart connection first, and then I decide whether I can say anything or not at that moment. And I've had a couple great times where like I said something in a certain way that I totally didn't agree with him, and it voiced my non-agreement, but it also maintained the open door. And now we have this funny thing, and I've gotten the funniest friend requests, like that I'll search them, and they're like random Trump supporters in the Midwest, and they're like, I sent you a friend request because I want to have an intelligent conversation. I'm like, I don't have the energy for this. Like, I'm not going to accept your friend request because I definitely don't have the energy for this in my life. But like, it's kind of a sweet thing. Like, and so just my trick for that, like finding even the neutral words that aren't somehow charged, is to go back into the heart and be like, all right, like, this is a human being that wants to be happy. And like, so far it's been mostly okay.
Just that. Yeah. I appreciate that. I missed the one-to-one connection,
yeah.
You know? Like, I'm in a 12-step group, and the thing that I loved about that was I instantly had community, right? We all were damaged, and we all came to that place,
right?
And everyone was on equal footing. And I can't get there with society, you know, it's like, so I'm wondering, where do you practice to get there,
right.
You know, with people that are my complete opposites, I guess, that's where I'm stuck,
right.
You know, I don't know if it's going to, like, you know, the meeting you mentioned last week, you know, so that's where I think, you know, I just have to get out and do local social justice issues, because I just don't.
Well, and I think now it takes work, because there aren't the social places, the social gathering places that there used to be. There aren't the watering holes that we would all gather around. It's hard to get out of our like-minded groups to find any kind of community. You're absolutely right. The other thing... There are some things, I think, that we're not good at in our culture. And one of them is disagreeing. We've had this very... I feel like we're babies. Like, we've been babied. We've been... And Linnell Walker, she's a priest on my staff. She's my Yoda. She's like my wise person, and I don't like to do anything without checking with her and getting her wisdom. And one of the things that she said a couple of weeks ago in one of our conversations, she said, America is the only country where the people think they shouldn't have to suffer. And, you know, because, and I don't want to debate that on its merits, right? We can look at other, right? But there's this thing about shouldn't have to suffer. When all around the world life is suffering and life is hard, and rather than building resilience around suffering, like other cultures who have a better relationship with death, right? Rather than building resilience around suffering, we just get indignant in front of it. I should never, like, how dare this happen? Rather than being, oh, this happens, and this is how we do it. Anyway, it's that same sort of thing, is that we don't know, like, we're not Italian enough. We need to, like, throw dishes and yell at each other and then know that that's how we love, right? But there's something, right? There's skills that we seem to have lost as a culture. that we're realizing, you know, we need. So, yes?
When they were talking about forgiveness and the thing that Heather mentioned about the indignation and the like superiority, and I really had a sense that that's masking the hurt underneath. Like, because it's so much easier to go into that place, which is a shield, rather than when somebody has hurt me, that's a place, and I recognize that, that's a place of vulnerability. And it's scary to be vulnerable to somebody that has the power to hurt me and is, you know, like that. And so that, again, that inability to feel the discomfort of feeling hurt and vulnerable.
Right.
And running from that.
Thank you all very much. This has been a treat, and I appreciate being invited in for these 3 weeks.
Thank you. Just a little appreciation from our group.
Oh,
the 2 o'clock, everybody signed.
Thank you.
Flower.
Thank you.
I get a bouquet for ladies. I never heard of guys. But thank you so much for visiting.
Thank
you. I was impromptu.
Yeah, and
really,
if you didn't know, Orchids represents love.
Oh, very nice.
Yes.
Very nice.
And next week, this time, Tuesday, we have prayers and music and potluck. What else?
Oh, can I add to this? Next Tuesday, after the music and celebration, we're actually going to gather the personal care items and make packages for the homeless. So anything that you have in your house, any kind of hotel, leftovers, any toothpaste, toothbrushes, shampoos, conditioners, soaps, hairbrushes, Band-Aids, girls' hygiene products, anything.
Clothing?
Would be, I'm sorry?
No, clothing.
Clothing is always good. Socks, underwear, hats, gloves. Right now, a lot of stores have $1 deals when you can get, for $1, you can get a hat or scarves or gloves. Socks, underwear, jackets, pants. Don't have to be new, those items. So if you hustle around the house and you have something, please bring it. We're going to stay, and like for 15 minutes after the class, we're just going to assemble them real quick. And then we're going to hand them out on Christmas morning when we're going to head out and feed the homeless around town. And also this Friday we have a homeless breakfast at the Friendship Park at Loaves and Fishes. And we're still needing food donations. We feed about 200 people every third Friday of the month. So if you have any hard-boiled eggs at home, cheese sticks, what else do we do?
Granola bars,
banana sandwiches, cheese, whatever you guys have and you're willing to offer, we'll be really appreciative because it's all going to go straight from our hands into the local folks in town who are suffering. So thank you very much. Oh, let me know if you want to do something and I'll get your contact info.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
Yes.